Welcome to the Anarchist Book Club with Jim Yeoman and me, Danny Evans. For this episode, we were joined by Martha Acklesberg, whose pioneering book, Free Women of Spain, marks its 30th anniversary this year. The book, which is subtitled Anarchism and the Struggle for the Emancipation of Women, remains the standard work on the Mujeres Libres, an autonomous grouping of women within the Spanish anarchist movement, which became a formal organisation numbering tens of thousands of members during the Spanish Civil War. Martha's work has been very influential on both Jim and myself, and we were thrilled that she agreed to chat with us about this fascinating subject. We hope you enjoy the programme.
Welcome, Martha, to the podcast. Thank you very much for coming on. And we decided to have this chat, really, because it's 30 years since the publication of your brilliant book, Free Women of Spain, something I know has been very influential in Danny's work and my own. So we're really delighted to be able to talk about that with you today. One thing, when I was returning to the book ahead of this podcast, I looked at more closely than normal. I think I looked at the acknowledgements. I don't often look at that page, but I thought it was a really, just really brilliant reflection of the array of activists and participants you encountered in your research and, you know, conducting all the kind of things that went into the book. And that just made me think it would be a nice place to start, really, would be to ask you to reflect on, you know, how you came about writing Free Women of Spain and how you found the research process.
Right. Well, first of all, thank you so much for inviting me to do this. It's hard for me to believe that it's been 30 years that the book is out. And so it's kind of fun to reflect on these questions. I guess I would say, you know, writing this book is an example of it. It takes more than a village, I think, but it took me a lot of different villages, being located in many different communities of people who supported me in this process. It grew out of my PhD dissertation, which was what did I title it? The Possibility of Anarchism. And it was mostly about anarchist theory, but it had a couple of chapters on anarchism and practice in Spain, one on the collectives and one on questions of politics, the whole question of whether anarchists should engage with the government during the period of the Spanish Civil War. And I then went back to Spain, I guess in the late 70s, early 80s, to try to begin whatever was going to be the process of turning it into a book and doing more research on the collectives. And by that point, I had become much more aware of my feminism as having an impact on my scholarship. At the time that I wrote the dissertation, I was involved in feminist activism here, but I didn't see the connection to my scholarship, which now seems absurd because anarchism seems like an ultimate expression of feminism and feminism and anarchism, but that's a whole other question. In any case, I went to Spain trying to find information about gender relations within the collectives. You know, there were a few people that I had met here through academic networks and then through others who were able to connect me with people in Spain who were much more involved in activist networks, because Spain was at that point just beginning to open up after Franco's death. But it was very difficult to find women. All the people I had access to, almost all the people I had access to, were men. And every time I asked them about women or gender relations, they would say things like, oh, the women didn't do very much, or they weren't very involved, or, you know, they just weren't very helpful. Until, you know, at some point, and I tell this story in the book, one of these guys, Enrique Casañas, whom I had visited a number of times, told me one time when I was there visiting, he said, you know, there's going to be a reunion here next week of some women who were involved in the Civil War. Maybe you'd be interested. I mean, he knew very well that I would be interested, but, you know, he was sort of being a little bit tongue-in-cheek. Anyway, he got me invited to this, and it was a visit of Luce Fabri, who had come to Spain with her father during the time of the Civil War. And there were a number of women there, Lola Iturbe and a couple of others who had some connection to Mujeres Libres, and they were talking about Mujeres Libres. And I was astounded because I had heard of the group, but I had no idea that any of the people who were involved in it were still alive or that it would be possible to talk with them. But Lola had connections, and she gave me the names of some people, and it became a kind of snowball process after that. And it was incredibly exciting to meet these people, to hear about their lives, and to realize that, I mean, over the course of this, I was able to connect some of them with others who didn't realize, you know, they had been out of touch and they didn't know how to be in touch with one another. And so they didn't necessarily know that the others were still alive. And anyway, so that's basically what happened. It was one person leading to another, leading to another, leading to another in Spain, and then some connections across the ocean to people in Canada, and then, you know, just incredible network of support from my various both activist and academic feminist communities here. It takes a lot to write a book. And it took a lot for me to write this one. It was, you know, 15 years of research, really, before it came out.
Well, I mean, that just sounds like an extraordinary experience. Perhaps now would be a good time if you to introduce Mujeres Libres, perhaps to some of our listeners who aren't particularly familiar with the grouping. Could you describe what Mujeres Libres was? And obviously it's a big question, but summarize what its significance was in the context of Spanish anarchism.
Sure. So Mujeres Libres was an organization of and for women in Spain that was founded officially in August of 1937, but grew out of a series of meetings and groupings of women from within the anarchist movement, most of them young, in their teens or maybe early 20s, who were part of various anarchist either unions or Ateneos Libertarios, these kind of storefront cultural centers or cultural groups, neighborhood-based organizations. So they either got involved in the movement through unions or through these kind of more cultural groups, which were largely male. And many of them found that they were, I guess, to put it simply, not taken seriously by their male colleagues or counterparts. The guys made fun of them, didn't take them seriously as equal participants in either union activities or cultural activities, expected them to do all the cleaning of the place and not really participate in activities or discussions. And in various different places and contexts, different women got, almost like teenage girls, got disgusted with the process, and they decided to get together with others and talk about what they could do about it. Some of this happened in Madrid with two of the women who ended up being among the founders, Lucia Sanchez Ornil, who was a poet and a journalist, and Mercedes Coma Posada, who was a lawyer, actually, and a journalist. And in Barcelona, the third so-called founder was Amparo Poch, who was a physician. But there were also lots of just sort of small affinity groups of young women who got together out of these contexts and started talking to one another and formed little support groups that would give them kind of like consciousness-raising groups almost that you would think of in the second wave of the feminist movement that was important to my becoming a feminist in the 1970s in the States. And at a certain point in the during 1936, really, and into 1937, once after the war had already broken out, they realized, they started hearing about one another, and the group in Barcelona heard about the group in Madrid, and they invited one another, they started meeting with one another. The Barcelona women had planned a big gathering in May of 1936, and they invited some of the Madrid folks to come, and lots of people came, and they eventually started this organization that became, by 1937, they had a federation. They formed the Federation of Mujeres Libres that had, you know, tens of thousands of members, but it was formed out of these small kind of affinity groups that existed in different parts of the country. They saw themselves as trying to really empower and engage women to participate in the social revolution. Their perception of themselves was as a kind of fourth branch of the libertarian movement. The movement in Spain had three main organizations at the time, the Confederación Nacional del Trabajo, the CNT, which was the Anarcho-Syndicalist Labor Union Confederation, the FAI, Federación Anarquista Ibérica, which was the anarchist, they called themselves a sort of more pure anarchist affinity-based groups, and the Juventudes Libertarias, youth organization. And the women who went on to be found and be or become active in Mujeres Libres, I think they were members of any and all of those organizations, but I think they felt that they weren't really full and equal members of any of them because the men in those organizations did not take them or women's issues seriously. And so they established this organization to enable them to participate more fully in the social revolution along with these other groups. And they, most of them continued their membership in whatever other group they were in. They were also members of the union. They were members of the Juventudes, but they were also in Mujeres Libres. One of the other things I would say, I guess, in terms of its larger significance for the movement is that they were hoping through their activities, they did a lot of writing, they wrote books, they wrote articles for the newspaper, they established their own journal called Mujeres Libres, that they were directing themselves primarily to women, but they were also trying to raise the consciousness, I think, of men in the movement to take their female compañeras more seriously.
I think that's a really interesting point, Martha. Do you think that's like the key distinguishing feature of Mujeres Libres as opposed to autonomous women's organizations within, you know, the socialist movement that had existed up to that point? I mean, it seems that in most of the major socialist, whether Marxist, anarchist, what have you, movements that had existed up until the interwar period, there'd often been women's sections or autonomous women's organizations, but they tended to have as their primary emphasis raising the level of consciousness or education of working class women, which perhaps was assumed to be starting from a lower starting point than of working class men. Whereas with Mujeres Libres, as you mentioned, it's not only directed at women, preparing women for participation in anarchism, right, in the social revolution, as you say, but also in challenging men to be prepared for equal social relations as well.
I think that, you know, it was in some ways a more, they defined themselves and as primarily as an organization of and for women. And I think if you ask them, the main way that they would say that they were different from let's say the socialist or the communist women's organization is that they really were autonomous. They were not the women's auxiliary of the socialist movement or the anarchist movement. They were their own independent group, and they defined what their agenda was. They weren't there to be support for male anarchist or male anarchist activities. They also understood a lot of the socialist and the communist women's organizations as meant to somehow mobilize women for the socialist movement or for the communist movement, in a sense, to help out the men. Whereas Mujeres Libres didn't see themselves as an auxiliary of the movement. They were trying to mobilize women with anarchist perspectives, but not for the purpose of helping the movement, but for the purpose of being able to engage fully as equals. So their primary orientation was toward women. But, you know, I do think this is, that it certainly was true for them, and so far as I can tell, much truer for them than for the socialist or the communist organizations. In their mobilizing and empowering of women, they were encouraging women to stand up for themselves within the movement and take their places, which meant sometimes being ready, willing, and able to challenge men. And they did, you know, they did orient themselves toward men, toward the larger anarchist movement, in the sense of trying to make it clear that women were there, needed to be treated as equals. They advocated campaign, you know, they had campaigns to try to convince male anarchists and militia members not to patronize prostitutes, to treat women as fully equal members. So while their main orientation was toward women, yes, they did also orient themselves toward trying to hold the larger anarchist movement to account, hold them accountable to their, to the principles that they supposedly stood by, which were that all human beings are equal.
I find that really interesting, not least because obviously it's quite different by the 1930s, but all of this does really remind me of things that kind of anarchist feminists and anarchist women were saying, you know, for decades earlier within the anarchist movement, you know, that the men didn't respect them in the same ways. They weren't treated as equal comrades, or anarchism had a long history in Spain, as you well know, like your own work on the kind of turn of the century, anarchist feminism in Spain and Argentina. It's always been there in principle. But what seems, you know, different here by the 1930s is that the scale of mobilization of Mujeres Libres. So whilst the concerns might be quite similar to those kind of pioneering anarchist feminists like Soledad Gustavo, Teresa Claramu, and so on, I wondered how much Mujeres Libres drew on that kind of lineage or heritage that comes from within, you know, the movement in Spain. And if these are the daughters of those anarchists, say, at the turn of the century, and, you know, they have kind of taken advantage of the great cultural blossoming of anarchism in Spain at that point, and the, you know, the education and so on. And if you think that Mujeres Libres emerges out of that tradition, but is able to kind of operate much more kind of fully than what's come before.
That's a really interesting question. I mean, some of them, the more educated of them, clearly were aware of that tradition. They had probably read some of these people. But, I mean, where they differed, of course, I mean, Claramunt and Soledad Gustavo and some of those earlier ones didn't have a women's mass movement with them. They were more kind of intellectuals who participated in anarchist journals and things like that. Most of the women who were involved in Mujeres Libres, some of the women who, let me just put it this way, of the women who were involved in Mujeres Libres, some came from political anarchist or socialist families and probably knew of that history, but a lot of them didn't. A lot of them somehow found unions or cultural centers or movement spaces on their own. a number of them talked about how even if they came from anarchist families, their parents were not happy to have them as girls going off to these meetings on their own. So I think it was clearly they came to know that history, but I don't think it was the history that enabled them exactly. I think the history was there to support them when they found it. A number of them, I'm thinking about some of the people who told me about that first meeting in Barcelona that they were trying to set up in May, I believe it was, of 1936. And they tried to get some of the older women to come along, and the older women were not necessarily all that interested. The older women, even Federica Monsen, for example, she was not wanting so much to recognize the issue of the oppression of women within the movement. So I think that was one of the areas where the younger generation maybe took a different tack than the older. They were willing to and wanting to be more explicit about the sexism they were experiencing and really demanding that movement activists, their compañeros, live up to the beliefs and the principles, which, as you said, they were stating as early as 1872, you know, that men and women should be equal and should be paid equally and should be equal in the family and all this kind of stuff. And I think some of that older generation wasn't quite willing to criticize their comrades so directly.
You've set the scene really well, I think, Martha, of like these groupings coming together in Barcelona and Madrid in the spring of 1936, which in some ways fortuitous timing, I suppose, in the sense that these women are coming together and discussing possibilities of women's anarchist activity just on the brink of this rupture that's going to take place in Spanish society that radically changes the context for that activity, obviously in ways that are often disturbing as well as like exciting and hopeful. But in the debate that is constantly controversial and never ending with regard to this period of Spanish history, the Civil War and the Revolution, there continues to be debate about the extent to which the Revolution transformed the lives and opportunities of Spanish women. So I was wondering what your take on that is, and specifically where Mujeres Libres fit within that broader picture.
Wars do tend to transform the lives of everybody, and this one certainly did. Many thousands, hundreds of thousands of men, you know, went to the front to fight, and that left a lot of the economy effectively in the hands of women. And I think it was largely as a result of the war and that transformation of relationships and their social world that Mujeres Libres started. They had their programs of what they called capacitación, which, you know, there isn't really a word in English. I used empowerment in the book. It sort of doesn't really capture what the Spanish means, but it's the closest word we have. But trying to enable women to really recognize their capacities and exercise them. So they had programs they had literacy programs. They established schools in all different kinds of places, adult schools for women so that they could learn how to read and they could learn history and literature. They had they taught classes about women's health and child rearing and stuff like that. But I think one of the ways in which the war profoundly affected that was that they recognized that women were going to be moving into, or women were already moving into, industry and paid work in a way that they had not really been able to do in most places before. I mean, women had been primarily, let's say, in textile workers, and aside from that, domestic workers. But you started having women doing many more different kinds of work in farms and agricultural areas. You had women taking over buses and trams. You had women doing industrial work, all kinds of stuff like this that they never, in that day, they would not have imagined themselves doing before. Those apprenticeship programs, both for women and run in conjunction with the unions, were a very important part of what Mujeres Libres did. And I think, and this was another one of the things I tried to emphasize in the book, that their take on that was another approach that distinguished them from what they saw as the approach of communist and socialist movements at the time. They saw this rupture and the transformation of the economy as obviously on the one hand problematic, but on another hand, an opportunity for women to learn and take on all kinds of social and economic roles that they had never had before and that many of them wanted access to. So the apprenticeship programs were, in their view, enabling women to take their places during the Civil War, but they saw that as this was going to transform the society going forward. This was not just a temporary move. Whereas I think the socialist and communist organizations, at least from the point of view of Mujeres Libres, saw what they were doing as temporary, to enable women to fill in for the men. And then once the men came back or the war was over, that the women would go back to being the helpmates that they had always been before. So that was, you know, the kind of economic transformation was a really big part of what they were doing. And I think the cultural transformation as well. And that was important. There were a lot of propaganda trips that anarchist groups, representatives of different anarchist groups, took around the country. And Mujeres Libres trained women in public speaking so that they could participate and thereby speak not just to other women, but to men and be seen as speaking.
One of the tropes, I guess, of how some history writers try to play down the impact of the Spanish Revolution on the lives of women is precisely to sort of place that transformation just in a broader context of the demands of total war that would see, say, women entering heavy industry in the United States or the UK during the Second World War, for example. But I think in the context of revolutionary Spain as well, one of the things that's worth bearing in mind is that women were entering workplaces that were often collectivized or socialized. So it wasn't just a case of being on the shop floor, but also participating in assemblies that would actually have an impact on the running of the workplace. For example, perhaps it's an exceptional case, but in the socialized woodwork industry in Barcelona, which was run by the CNT, you had the secretary of that, the woodworkers union, Hernandez, being conscripted in, I think, towards the end of 1937, and his place being taken by Joaquina Dorado Pita, who's still a very young woman at that time, effectively with a leading role in a worker-run industry, which obviously was not something that had any precedent or would be followed up in any other of the sort of classic wartime situations that are sometimes referred to. While we're on this subject, it might be worth mentioning the role of women at the front and Mujeres Libres' attitude in relation to that, because I suppose the miliciana and the particularly the imagery of armed women remains one of the more enduring and striking images of the Spanish Civil War. So could you perhaps contextualize those images for us, Martha, and give us some idea of Mujeres Libres' relationship to that women's participation at the front?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question because, you know, it's interesting. The book has been translated into a number of different languages and published in various places. And, you know, almost every what everybody wants to put on the cover of the book is a picture of a miliciano holding a rifle. I mean, and I've said to almost all of them, that's really not who Mujeres Libres were, but obviously that's the imagery that people want for the Spanish Civil War. I mean, there were some women milicianas, and some of them did become members of Mujeres Libres, but Mujeres Libres was not primarily about supporting or being milicianas. They were primarily about working in what's called the rear guard, but they did go to the front in support roles on occasion. You know, they did the kind of thing that women typically traditionally do. They knitted socks and wool hats, and they went to the front to serve warm meals to soldiers and to help out with first aid and things like that. There were a few articles in Mujeres Libres's journal about women at the front. Clearly that was something that was exciting and which they wanted to support, but it was not really a major aspect of their activism.
I think that's a really, really interesting and important point to make. And, you know, we're not going to put a picture of a miliciana as the cover for this particular episode. It just so easily get drawn into that. Yeah, that, you know, the two are blended so often that I think that's what people think of.
I know. It's interesting that it's very hard to evoke a sense of how the war impacts people other than showing people with guns. You know, again, there were women with guns at the front, but not that many, and it was hardly the focus of Mujeres Libres' activities. I mean, it is interesting, however, that a couple of the women that I interviewed, both Pepita Carpena and Sara Berenguer, who were about 16 or 17 when the war broke out, both of them really wanted to go to the front. And in both cases, their father said to them, either their father or other older mentor in the movement said to them, no, this is not for you. You could do more and better and more important work here.
It also, you know, belies that notion that fighting is the only, or like the real way that women were emancipated. Whereas you make clear, as you've spoken today and in the book, how this is much broader. And, you know, it's covering all parts of kind of culture, economics. And one thing I wanted to ask, that both you and Danny, in Danny's book, Revolution in the State, you know, stress how, I find anyway, you can both disagree with me if you like, Mujeres Libres and their activities seem to be one of the things that the movement, you know, more broadly, one of the things that continues on during the war, past the great tragedy of the May Days in 1937, when many people kind of end the story of the revolution altogether. Whereas actually, the way that you talk about it, and Danny stresses as well, past this point, Mujeres Libres, those changes that you've discussed actually do continue on long past the milicianas are kind of withdrawn from the front by the central government. And so it becomes easy to say, oh, well, women's, you know, involvement and emancipation ended when the milicianas were drawn back from the front, only if you see that as the kind of prime example of it. Whereas actually, if you're looking at the organization, then really you're seeing much deeper and longer term changes.
I mean, that's a really important point, especially if you think that the Federation was established in August of 1937 and the milicias were withdrawn from the front in November, December of 1936, basically. You know, the militias were militarized at the end of 1936, beginning of 1937. So by then, you had almost no milicianas. You certainly had the activities of Mujeres Libres continued and grew, certainly, through till the end of the war and after. I mean, most of those, well, obviously, the only people I was able to interview were people who survived and who went, most of them, almost all of them that I interviewed, went into exile, which was partly how they survived. But they remained active in unions and movement organizations in France, which I don't think they, I mean, they continued their activism, and they continued their activism as equal partners long after the war was over. So for them, you know, their militancy as women was not a thing of the war period. It was a lifetime. It really did transformed not just the society at the time. Obviously, then when Franco came in, much of that was reversed. But for the individual women who were able to get to go into exile and live a life of relative freedom, that transformed who they were and who they were within the movement.
I think that's something that you really convey movingly and effectively in your book, Martha. To what extent do you think that Mujeres Libres succeeded in, I mean, what we've problematically described as the secondary aim of challenging Spanish anarchist men to behave differently and to sort of incorporate equality into their union practice and daily lives? What was the response of anarchist men to Mujeres Libres?
I think, as in so many other places in the world, it was mixed. You definitely had some men who were supportive. There were unions that really, union locals, for example, that really welcomed Mujeres Libres onto the shop floors and worked with them to create apprenticeship programs, you know, stopped the lines so that they could have meetings and stuff like that. I mean, there was real support from some anarchist men and organizations on the ground. And there were a lot, the sort of mainstream organizations and leaders did not give them the kind of support or recognition that they wanted. I think a lot of the anarchist men wished, or at least the movement leaders wished, that Mujeres Libres would be more like the socialist and the communist organizations, namely that they would see themselves as, to see their task, as it were, as primarily to mobilize women for the movement in the way that the socialist or the communist women were, rather than having their own agendas. There was a major all-regional conference of the anarchist movement in late 1938, at which Mujeres Libres asked to be recognized as the fourth independent branch, and it didn't happen because, I mean, they were prevented from bringing that up on a technicality, but clearly, while there were some men and some organizations who supported them, the mainstream organizations didn't see a need and I guess didn't want them to be the kind of pain in the ass that they were being or that they perceived them as being.
On one level, when we think about like the sort of how hierarchies became kind of consolidated in the anarchist movement during the war, a reluctance to acknowledge, you know, an autonomous organization, particularly of women, particularly that are saying like radical and challenging things, kind of makes sense from the point of view of a leadership that's struggling to maintain control over, you know, the anarchist movement more broadly. But one of the things that struck me in my research, and which I suppose in some ways I find harder to explain, is the way in which youthful purist anarchists who were like quite disaffected from the like CNT leadership by this point were also or could be, again it's ambiguous, but could be critical of Mujeres Libres just on the grounds that it's an autonomous women's organization.
It's a very tricky perspective, which people still have a lot of trouble with. I mean, they perceived autonomy as, or said anyway, I don't know whether they believed it or they just said it, that they couldn't distinguish or refuse to distinguish between autonomy and separatism. So what they said at the time was, we don't organize separately like this. We don't organize by men and by women. We are all fighting together for a society in which men and women will be equal. And therefore, on the basis of our understanding of anarchist principles, namely that we should all be equal, we have to be in an organization together. That's the same thing that, for example, Federica Montseny, she was not a member of and did not really initially support Mujeres Libres. She thought it wasn't necessary that people should work together within the existing movement organizations. Whereas the women of Mujeres Libres said, you know, fine, very well and good. You hold these ideals, but you don't treat us as equal. So we can't work together within this organization because you are treating us really as second class, if not worse. So the only way that we're going to be able to make this revolution is if you let us organize autonomously and together. We're going to stay in the unions with you. We're going to stay in the juventudes with you. But we need what's now called women's space, right? We need a space to organize where we can hear our own voices, where, as you know, in the words of our contemporary feminist theorists, we can hear ourselves into speech. That was not their language, but they knew that within a context where they were going to be ridiculed and shouted down and laughed at every time they tried to speak, how were they going to organize themselves? How were they going to get women to come into this movement that supposedly the men wanted the women in? From Mujeres Libres' point of view, and this happens in so many movements. It's not just them. It happened in Argentina. It happens, you know, I'm sure it's happening still in the UK. It happens here all the time. You say you're committed to equality, but what's going to force you to treat us equally is only if we have some independent place to stand, as it were, where you can't shout us down. And I think that's what Mujeres Libres was trying to say. That's what, you know, the similar organization in Argentina that, you know, existed in the late 19th and early 20th century was trying to say the same thing, that yes, we're in this together, but you are not living up to what you claim to believe. And this is the only way we can think of to make that happen.
I'm going to shift back again to almost where we started in thinking about the book, you know, your work on this fascinating subject and how you feel about the book kind of 30 years on, and if there's anything you'd change about how you approach the book or the conclusions that you drew. Would you have asked any questions of your participants now that you didn't do at the time? Just how do you relate to your book in this way?
Well, I guess I have to say I'm pleasantly surprised that it seems to have stood the test of time. I thought it was an approach to telling this story. I mean, I felt compelled to write the book once these women had let me into their lives. I felt like they have given me this incredible gift, and they have vouchsafed me with their stories. And I then had a responsibility to get those stories out as best I could in the way that was truest to them that I could. And at the same time, I felt very strongly that a lot of feminists in the United States, for example, needed to know what anarchism was about or could be about, because it seemed to me that a lot of feminists in the United States define themselves as socialist feminists, but it seemed to me that anarchism was a much better anti-hierarchical understanding, way to think about non-hierarchical organization that would work, would be a much better model than the socialist model, and people just didn't know about it. So partly it was about telling the stories, and partly it was about introducing this kind of collectivist feminist anarchism to U.S. audiences. And, you know, I guess what I've found rather astounding is how broad the interest seems to have been. There have not been very many other books trying to do this. I mean, the book has been translated into French, Spanish, Italian, Greek, Portuguese. It was published last year or the year before in Brazil. There is now a Russian translation, which I haven't seen yet, but it's out. And it's about to be published in a new Spanish version in Argentina. So somehow, even what I thought was very much oriented toward a U.S. feminist audience seems to have been able to reach many people outside of that context. And I'm thrilled, but I'm also surprised in some ways, I guess. Because it's had that kind of resonance, I'm generally pleased with how it came out. Although I think if I had the opportunity to interview some of those people again, I might have asked them more questions about sexuality, but I didn't feel comfortable doing that. They clearly didn't feel comfortable talking about it, so I didn't push.
Related to that, I absolutely agree that, you know, its resonance has been really broad and long-lasting. And, you know, anyone that listening to this that hasn't read it, I think you could go away and pick it up. And you wouldn't think this is a work that was written 30 years ago. It is still really resonant, really, really pertinent. And I wonder, you know, for me, I think one of the many reasons why that is the intertwining of oral history that you do through the book, the voices of the, you know, the participants there. It did make me think, just again, as a kind of practical level historian, someone that's very interested in oral histories, did you record those interviews on tape? And do you have those yourself? Are they at an institution? Is there that kind of archive there of Free Women of Spain still intact?
I did record many of them. Some of them did not give me permission to record, so I didn't. I just took notes. All of the recordings and all of my notes are in the archives at the University of Victoria, British Columbia, which is kind of a long story about how they got there, but I was told that they were collecting materials on Spain and that they would share it with archives in Spain. They are supposedly in the process of digitizing everything so that it will all be, but it is all in one place. That felt important to do.
Absolutely. And that's so exciting to learn that they might be digitized soon. So you've reflected a little, Martha, on the extraordinary longevity and success of the book. It's clearly found an audience. And I suppose it's really impossible to say this from the vantage point of any one individual about any one book. But given that your aim was to introduce today's feminist, or today, you know, 30 years ago, feminists of 30 years ago to Mujeres Libres, do you have a sense of the extent to which that's been a success? Do you have a feeling that people, that, you know, there has been some degree of feminists using Mujeres Libres as a resource for their own activism in the period since you wrote the book?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. I think that this book, I don't know for certain, but I think that the book has actually found much more of an audience outside this country than it did inside. I've heard much more from, it's not clear to me how many of the people for whom I wrote this book, I mean, they didn't necessarily know that I wrote it for them, so I have no idea who read it. But from what I've gathered in terms of people that I've met in other places, you know, in other countries when I've gone on book tours or whatever, it feels like they're, and that may be because the United States has really no significant socialist or even to some degree anarchist tradition. There is more, in a way, there's more resonance for this kind of social revolutionary activity outside of this country than inside, despite the fact that it was here that I wrote it. I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting to me as I look back on it now, and like, for example, when I went to Brazil 2 years ago, you know, the situation in the country and in the world is very different from what it was 30 years ago. And in some ways, I feel like we're in a much more difficult place. Things were somewhat more hopeful in terms of social change in the late 90s, certainly than they are now with the rise of the right in so many different places. But one of the things that's been really interesting to me is trying to think about the message, the lessons of the book and the lessons of Mujeres Libres, specifically in this kind of time. I remember saying, you know, when I was in Brazil and we were talking about Bolsonaro and Trump and all of the rise of all of these right-wing people all over the world and how discouraging it can be. And look, they were in the middle of a civil war with serious fascism. Thousands of people were dying. There was a hot war going on. And still, they were able to do amazing work. And if they could do that in the middle of a bloody and really very brutal civil war, we ought to be able to continue to struggle for a better world in this context in which we find ourselves now. So even though the Spanish Civil War was even longer ago now than it was when I wrote the book, and we are in a very different position, I still find their stories and this history to be incredibly inspirational. I think it holds up for us a model, a challenge, really, to make the best one can of one's situation, no matter how bad the political situation might seem to be.
That's lovely. I think it's a really good place to end the interview, actually. It's a fantastic response.
I'd like to thank you again for inviting me to do this and for the wonderful questions and conversations. It's very exciting to feel like the book and the issues that it was raising are still alive. So I really appreciate that. Thank you so much.
It's a privilege, really. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. We've got some new plans for the Anarchist Book Club that we'll be launching in the next few weeks. And our next book discussion will be Paul Avrich's classic, Kronstadt 1921, marking the centenary of this crucial event in radical history. As ever, if you'd like to get in touch and stay in touch with the podcast, our email is abcwithdannyandjim@gmail.com, and you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, both at @abcdannyandjim. The podcast music is Stealing Orchestra, Gente de Miña Tierra. The podcast logo is an adapted version of the Left Book Club logo. And the image in this episode is a photograph of a Mujeres Libres section during the Spanish Civil War, holding books and papers rather than rifles, which is available in the public domain. Love and solidarity. Until next time.
Senhor Secretário de Estado, faz favor, tenha a palavra, não existe.